The next case on our calendar is 03-1880, Northern Buckeye Education Council versus Karen Lawson. Mr. O'Neill.
I'd like to reserve 4 minutes, if I may, Your Honor.
Okay, watch your time there.
I appreciate the opportunity to be able to bring a claim of one of the citizens before this court. And I also wish to thank Emily Lawson and her family who were watching by internet and trusting me with this case and the privilege to represent them for their important claim before this important court and for other people who are similarly situated as Emily. This case involves a make-whole doctrine and full compensation and the limited rights of what a subrogation clause should be. This court has adopted the make-whole doctrine. In a syllabus opinion in 1995, by a unanimous court, this court wrote in its syllabus, authored by Justice Wright, that pursuant to the terms of an insurance contract, a health insurer that has paid medical benefits to insured and has been subrogated to the rights of the insured may recover from the insured after the insured receives full compensation. The terms of the subrogation clause are looked to after you see if the person who has been injured and who has other collateral insurance from the tortfeasor, before you look to see if they pay something back under a subrogation clause or not.
This case is all have something that distinguishes them from this, and that is there's no contract that provides for subrogation irrespective of whether someone is made whole. Seems to me most of the cases are different than this case, because here we have an express, well, we can argue about whether it's express enough, but let's assume that it is. Those cases are all different, aren't they?
No, I don't believe they are, Your Honor. It's a matter, I think this court, especially after listening for the last 2 hours of when the court uses its words, I think the court knows when it's using the words effectively. When you look for a subrogation agreement, the purposes of what a subrogation agreement was established in American jurisprudence was a balanced approach. That it was created in equity, and it was to pay back if somebody got a full property claim damage back, then under those circumstances, they would assign the right over to the insurer by law, because you don't want to make a double recovery or a windfall. And secondly, it has a moral obligation to help the person, the correct person, pay the damages, and that is the careless person. This decision in Horanco dealt with a health insurance, it dealt with a contractual right. It did not in any way say it's limited if you have some other contract on steroids that can overcome that. That was the establishment of the public policy. Two places in the Horanco decision, in the body of the decision, in addition to the syllabus itself, after they talk about subrogation clauses and the interpretation of those and the rights under those, they then take the public policy part of that. It goes, after the insured receives full compensation by way of settlement with the insured's uninsured motorist carrier. Further in the opinion, they go to the other aspect that's been looked at historically, and they said in this case that the insured is not getting any better than he would have been with full compensation. In fact, the wording is, and to receive the payment of medical expenses from both his group health carrier and uninsurance carrier would place the injured party in a better position than what he would have been before. So they're looking at the same lines. And there's been no issue with this of the following of this by the Ohio appellate courts until we got to this decision. The appellate courts have been that have looked at Ohio law, looked at Horanco, and followed that along with the purpose of insurance and the purpose of subrogation, have, except for this case, unanimously followed Horanco. Even another district court, the sixth district court earlier with three different judges on the panel, specifically found from the citations that are given in this case by Northern Buckeye that those were no longer the law. And they said, we follow the more recent pronouncement of this court, Horanco, and the first, second, fifth, and dicta of the 11th District Courts, and that was in Grind versus Payne. So there has been no problem of understanding what the law is in this area since Horanco. And if you look at the purpose of subrogation, it started out as balanced. It started out with property rights. It then has expanded into the area of personal injury, which has made it more complicated to a degree. But the make-whole doctrine has been the mainstream doctrine involved in this. There are a few states that don't let you split any cause of action at all and don't allow subrogation. There are some states that say the insurance company comes first. But the overwhelming number of jurisdictions and judicial concepts over the years has been the make-whole doctrine, because it provides a balance that when the person is made whole, then there is not a double recovery, and that they can pursue the tortfeasor themselves. You step into the shoes of the subrogated party once they're made whole. In this case, what is happening is that Northern Buckeye is trying to step in front of the shoes of their own insured and to collect causes of action that Emily Lawson would otherwise have.
The overwhelming majority of the cases you cite, however, as the chief pointed out in the Ohio cases, do say absent express contract. I believe your position is, even if there is an express contract, public policy dictates that the insurance company should not recover until the plaintiff has been made whole. Is that correct?
That is true. Okay. Emily Lawson, to look at this case and what deals with Citizens of Ohio. Emily Lawson was a 16-year-old girl at the time of the accident. Her leg was mangled. It was broken in a number of different areas. She has permanent neurological damages. Part of her muscle tissue was gone. She's woken up with flashbacks and nightmares. She can't walk like she could. She doesn't have the ability to support herself. She can't run. She's gone through 5 surgeries, and her leg is nowhere near it was. And when you have a situation like that with $85,000 worth of medical bills and a $100,000 policy here, and you look at the equities involved in it, is that she has a right from other people, and other people in her situation have a right to collect wage losses. Her parents lost wages, she lost wages, to collect medical bills that aren't covered by the plan, to collect for things such as physical impairments, of inability to do things. And what's happening is her own insurance company, through a subrogation clause, is trying to step in front of her and take those property rights and assets away from them for the purpose of their own purposes.
Yep. If we accept your proposition, how do you reach the determination of when the plaintiff has been made whole? Is it done by another mini trial? Is it done by arbitration? What is the mechanism? You claim your client may be worth $500,000. Your claim is $500,000. The other party says it's worth $250,000. So you've gotten $250,000, but not $500,000. How do you make that determination? What is the mechanism you propose?
Okay. How do you settle any case? How does a plaintiff's attorney and defense counsel settle any case for what the value of the case is? If somehow there's always a cooperation clause, if the counsel believes that it's worth $125,000 or $150,000, and then if you almost always have to indemnify the subrogated party if they think you've done something wrong, then they have a process through a cooperation clause and a consent clause, and they can pursue an indemnity. So before you get rid of the claim, there's an indemnity. They sign off, or as plaintiff's attorney,
so
you make sure.
If you can't settle and you don't agree, what is the mechanism then?
The mechanism is a jury trial. I mean, if you ultimately can't settle that issue. But the purpose of insurance, the entire purpose of insurance is to take a catastrophe that may occur and to spread it among a pool of people so that no single individual has to suffer that catastrophe. That's the entire purpose of insurance. And these subrogation clauses go against that entire purpose. They're taking the catastrophe, taking a premium for it, and then as soon as there's some money from the tortfeasor, they take it all back and give it back to the pool.
Well, but the consortium of school boards here, which has the policy, as you know, says we paid medical bills. We didn't pay. This wasn't an auto insurance policy that provides for pain and suffering and so forth. We paid medical bills of $85,000. We'd like to be reimbursed by her because she's a part of her $250,000. I guess that she's received includes these medical bills. And that to go beyond that really isn't fair to the rest of the insureds under our policy.
Could I give you a little bit of a longer answer? Let me
give
you
whatever answer you want.
Okay. If Emily Lawson caused her own injuries, they would pay the bills and there wouldn't be subrogation. If a plan member was hit by lightning, they would pay the bills and there wouldn't be subrogation. If somebody has cancer or cardiovascular problems, whether they're overweight or ate too much or were smokers, they would pay the bills and there wouldn't be subrogation. If you have somebody who is independently wealthy and has certain reserves to pay the medical bills, they would pay the medical bills and there wouldn't be subrogation. This clause in this particular case falls on those people who are the most innocent because they didn't cause their injury and the most seriously injured because they end up exhausting the funds of other people. They're the people who need the wage losses more than anybody else because they don't have any health anymore. They're the ones who can't walk. They're the ones who may need bills for other medical.
But if this is a contract, we have a conflict here, don't we, between a contract which into which she entered, insurance policy by this consortium of school boards, and it's a contract, and we have that in conflict with the premise that somebody should be made whole under uninsured motorist, and there's a conflict here. So, all these other facts, it seems to me, are not the issue. The question is, what viability do we give the contract here that says, as I say, we can argue about whether the contract is expressed enough, but that says, in essence, we, the insurance company, are going to be entitled to receive reimbursement for what we paid you at the outset when you needed to have your medical bills paid. That's a contract issue. Is that against public policy, or what's?
Yeah, it is for a number of reasons, but among those is that what you're taking away to have them reimbursed is other cause of actions and other property rights of the individual. You don't take away their houses, you don't take away their cars. If they have a lawsuit over some lease thing, you don't take those things away. The other causes of action they have of wage loss, impairment to capacity to earn, need for other medical bills where they paid $15,000, you're throwing that burden and taking away the purpose of insurance, and you're putting the catastrophe back on the most innocent, needy people for that contract. And that's why you don't enforce this type of contract, because they're stepping in front of their own insureds. They paid a premium to have the medical bills paid. They paid the premium, and then when they come to get the benefit, it just goes through a door and comes back.
But this is a contract provision, which was part of a contract made really for the benefit of your client.
Well,
it also has, for example, a deductible provision. If we would sort of amend this to eliminate the subrogated interest, as you suggest, what would prevent someone from saying, well, we're not going to have deductibles, even though they're written into the contract, we don't have to pay them. You see, there's really no end to our amendment of terms of a contract that have been entered into, as the chief points out, by the association for the benefit of individuals.
The subrogation clauses have been looked at historically as for very limited purposes. They have always been that way. And in this particular case, if you look at the subrogation plan, the provision in the plan, it's at page 225 in the record. It's not a subrogation contract with steroids like they want. There's a provision in there that's very generic, and they say we can have her sign a subrogation agreement that the administrator provides to her, okay? And there's no choice really. And then when they give the mother the actual subrogation agreement, which the trial court says was not made available to her when the plan was adopted, it is not referenced anywhere in the long plan from page 208 to 272, and it shows up on page 273. Then it adds some other provisions saying, irrespective of other cause of actions, we get first. We get first dibs. That's where the first dibs came in. It came on in a contract that was provided from a subrogation reimbursement agreement to sign this mother. And the mother's answer was, I'm not going to sign it, and they stopped paying the medical bills. And in order to have the medical bills paid and the threat that her daughter wasn't going to be paid, then she had to sign the subrogation agreement. But this court has looked at about a dozen different contracts in a bunch of situations, and if a contract or conduct has a tendency to be something that is injurious to the public, has that tendency, then this court has found those against public interest, such as the shortening of the statute of limitations, cognovit notes against consumers, suppressing criminal charges by way of contract. There is a public policy for full redress. There is a public policy for insurance. And in this case, they have conceded that you don't go in and you don't have an option. I'll take option A with subrogation, option B with subrogation with make-whole doctrine, option C without that. Their suggestion in their brief is the mother ought to find some other job.
Counsel, I want to test an impression I have, and maybe it is, maybe it's wholly an error. Maybe it's just the practice rather than the law. But I thought generally that lawyers on all sides of these issues, when approaching a subrogation agreement for the health insurer and you have a settlement, that they looked at this and tried to agree. Are they getting 50 cents on the dollar? Are they getting 25 cents on the dollar in terms of the whole claim? In other words, the medical bills represent, and you allege here that the judge or somebody said this is a $400,000 or $500,000 case, and then they prorated that, and that was generally what happened. In other words, if for future medical expenses, for present future pain and suffering, disfigurement, loss of wages, there are a lot of things mixed up in a.
Correct.
A claim of this nature, that the actual medical bills represent whatever portion of reasonable people can agree on it, and that's the amount that is and should be in play for subrogation purposes, generally. I mean, if you didn't have this tacked on additional agreement that the mother signed, if you were just going off the contract itself,
I would say, if I think I'm following what you're saying, I think you're talking about an area where there is enough coverage and there is enough people there. There is enough funds there. The funds of insurance are, let me go a little bit, so, is to spread the risk as far as you can. That's the purpose of it, not to hone it in on an individual. This anti-make-whole clause is a recognition that there is not enough money.
Right, I understand.
That they ditch in front for every other right she has against the tort fees.
Okay, no, but I'm talking about when there isn't enough money. Like here, $100,000, let's say, and let's say for purpose of the argument, it's a legitimate $500,000 claim, and there's $100,000 available. So, and the medical bills are 85. So 85 as to the 100,000 gives you a fraction, and so then you, that is not the practice, I take it.
I would say that I don't believe that's a practice, except for when there's comparative negligence stuff, and then people prorate that stuff out, because that has not gone to the way of make whole, but that hasn't fit in the formula. So you said, well, there's some problems here, we don't know if this medical applies, this is an injury that
and
we
your
don't
argument
think
is the practice has been if you're not made whole.
If somebody has lost their leg, yeah. and there's a $12,500 policy, then the person who lost their leg ought to get the $12,500, and they shouldn't be trying to prorate the medical. That's what our position is, and whether it is,
could the benefits plan here have said to her, to the plaintiff's mother, you have insurance. And the tortfeasor may have insurance. This is a medical policy, and your insurance policy certainly covers medical costs in an accident such as this, a terrible accident. Could they under their policy, could they have said you go to the tortfeasor or you go to your own insurer and before we pay anything? Do you know with the contract?
If the mother doesn't sign, I think that there would be then a. Otherwise,
that's
I think that the contract says pay the bills. The purpose of the medical policy is to pay the bills. The real harm is what if you have a medical policy and a disability policy and a supplemental medical policy, and they all have these clauses in there. And then you dealing with the loss and sitting in the back of the courtroom watching three different insurance companies parcel up the tortfeasor's funds when they ought to be the ones getting it, and they're the ones in the greater need of it. The purpose of insurance, again, is to spread the risk. It's not to cheat somebody. She's not making a windfall. It's not a double recovery. If anybody's making a double recovery, it's the insurance company, because we cited things that they don't put this in the rate making. There's not an iota evidence that this is going to decrease their premiums or help them. There's an amicus by about six people, and they don't put them in there, and they're getting the premiums, plus they're getting all their money back, and you've got destitute, innocent, needy people who are not fully compensated and may end up in bankruptcy court.
You've used your time, Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you.
Ms. Dawson.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name's Jennifer Dawson. I represent the Northern Buckeye Education Council. The overriding public policy at issue in this case is the fundamental freedom to enter into a contract with the expectation that the terms of that contract will be enforced. As this court specifically held in Nottingtail v. Darby.
Counsel, which contract are we talking about? The underlying policy of insurance, or are we talking about the add-on, which is provided for in the underlying policy of insurance?
Your Honor, we contend that they are both part of the contract. And even if you look at them each individually, we believe that the rights of contract that we are trying to uphold here apply.
Okay, and you believe that your client would have the absolute right to submit a subrogation agreement after this accident that alters and enhances the rights of recovery,
pardon me, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that the actual plan document provides for these rights. The plan document under Section 3.7, subrogation rights, provides that any payment made by this plan for injury or illness caused by the negligent or wrongful act of any third party are made with the agreement and understanding that the covered person will reimburse the plan for any amounts which are later recovered from the third party. The plan will be subrogated to all of the covered person's rights of recovery against a third party to the extent of any payments made by the plan. That's in the plan document. The plan document further goes on to say.
But there are some extra words in the supplemental that was signed that seem to even bolster your claim on the funds.
Well, Your Honor, I know that argument has been made, but when I look at the actual plan documents versus the subrogation agreement, I see them saying the same thing, perhaps in slightly different words. But if I can go on with the plan document says the claims administrator will withhold payments of claims to the extent that the claims administrator has actual knowledge of a negligent or wrongful act of a third party until a covered person executes a subrogation or reimbursement agreement. So it is the plan's contention that both the plan document and the subrogation agreement provides for the rights that are being that we hope to protect here today. In Irvin v. Garner, a case in which this court enforced a contractual subrogation provision, even though the insured was not fully compensated, this court stated, cases of contractual interpretation should not be decided on the basis of what is just or equitable. This concept is applicable even where a party has made a bad bargain. It is the court's duty to interpret the meaning of contracts and reach a decision by using the usual tools of contractual interpretation and not by a determination of what is just, fair, and equitable. Given this overriding public policy in favor of enforcing clear and unambiguous contracts as written, this court should find the contract at issue here unenforceable only if it's clearly and undeniably against public policy. The test for determining whether a contract provision is against public policy is whether its purpose is injurious to the public or contravenes some established interest of society. The contract can be held unenforceable if and only if it's found to be illegal, immoral, fraudulent, cruel, shocking, injurious to the public, or contravenes some established interest of society. This contract falls into none of those categories. The contract is not illegal, immoral, or fraudulent. Neither Ohio nor any of the federal statutes that regulate the insurance industry prohibit subrogation agreements. The contract simply provides a benefit to employees. No one is required to enter into the contract. Any employee can simply decline to enter into the contract.
Counsel, where I have difficulty thinking about this issue is where, like in the case of this young woman, there is apparently not enough money to cover the entire injury. So there's $100,000, and I assume your clients would probably agree that the nature of the injury exceeds that.
We do not contest that.
Yeah. So when you take the $100,000, this young woman's taken a haircut all the way around. But contractually, you attempt, you make the medical bills the first money paid. In other words, the $100,000 it's for medical bills to the extent there were medical bills, and every other part of the injury takes all of the haircut. I have trouble understanding why that is so.
Well, Your Honor, the parties agreed that this is what the contract would provide. This is a health benefit contract. The contract says we will provide you benefits, and we did. Ms. Lawson did get her medical benefits paid for.
Yeah, but your contract, I'm apparently not articulating my concern very well. Your contract says that you get any money that she recovers, but she recovers money for medical, she recovers money for pain and suffering, she recovers money for lost wages, future, past and present and future. But your recovery is only for medical bills. It's not identified and as to what she recovers. It's $100,000. And it seems that you're taking part of the recovery that was for other things.
Well, Your Honor, we keep going back to, and I do understand your question, and perhaps I'm not being articulate in answering it, but we do keep going back to, this is what we agreed to. We agreed to, in the case of a third party causing the injury, that we will advance the payment for your medical bills, but only on the condition that if you then recover against the tortfeasor, you reimburse us. And that was the contract that both parties agreed to.
Counsel, is there any element of unconscionability?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe there is at all. This contract simply provides a benefit to employees. No one is required to enter into it.
What is their alternative if they don't enter into a health insurance contract?
Well, with respect to insuring the kinds of injuries that are like pain and suffering and lost wages, which are what the Lawson's claim have not been fully covered, any employee is free to purchase additional uninsured motorist coverage. That's the coverage that is for lost wages and pain and suffering and so forth. We are a health benefits plan. In addition,
well, if there were a recovery in this instance of just say $90,000, and in order to attain that, there had to be an attorney engaged and paid, what would be her recovery if it was a one-third contingency contract on the $90,000?
Well, Your Honor,
would it be your contention you get the full 85 Or if she only recovered actually 60 and the lawyer was paid 30, would your recovery be 60? How do you interpret that?
Well, in this case, we believe the contract provides that, that's not an issue in the case before this court, but we would contend that our contract provides that we are entitled to the 85. That is the deal we entered into, and that we step in the shoes of Ms. Lawson.
So she has to pay someone to collect that money. You don't feel that you have to pay anyone to collect it for you?
Well, I believe, again, it's an issue that should be determined by the contract. And in this case,
what if she only collected money for pain and suffering, didn't collect any for medical bills?
Well, we go back to the contract. This contract says, regardless of how it's termed, we are only extending these benefits, we are only advancing these benefits to you, these payments to your medical providers, so long as you agree to pay us back from money that you get from the tortfeasor.
You've entered into a contract to pay all those bills. That was the initial contract you entered into, to pay all of them.
Well, Your Honor, we entered
into... Am I right or wrong?
Well, Your Honor, we entered into a contract to pay those bills for illness. But if the injury or illness is caused by a third party, it's just an advancement. We say we will advance.
But you told us that your plan administrator said, I won't pay them unless you sign this subrogation agreement, so I want to stop paying them.
That's right, Your Honor.
Despite your obligation to pay them anyway.
No, Your Honor, I was trying to make a distinction. Perhaps I wasn't clear. If it's an illness, cancer or something like that, then the obligation is to pay them. It's an illness plan. If the injury or the medical bills are as a result of an accident caused by a third party, then it is a contingent obligation. The obligation is there to advance the benefits so long as the insured person agrees to reimburse. That's the plan, Your Honor, we believe clearly states that. The contract is not injurious to the public. In fact, enforcing this contract benefits all citizens of Ohio, all of whom have an interest in making sure that they can rely on courts to enforce contracts as written, and all of whom have an interest in insurers continuing to write insurance in Ohio. The members of this self-funded nonprofit plan allocate risks and pay the costs of providing health care benefits to public school employees and dependents based on those risks. Each member's share of the cost of the health care benefits program reflects the type of benefits that each particular member school district agrees to provide its employees. The plan chosen by Ms. Lawson's employer included a subrogation and reimbursement agreement. Enforcing the subrogation and reimbursement provision, therefore, provides each party the benefit of its bargain. This court has enforced similar subrogation and reimbursement contracts in the past. In Peterson v. Ohio Farmers, a case in which there was a written subrogation agreement, this court held that resolution of a subrogation claim was to be determined according to the terms and conditions of the written subrogation agreement, even though the insured was not fully compensated.
Counselor, what is the plaintiff's, here the appellant's, option for health coverage if they're not with the plan? Private purchase?
Private. Yes, private.
Okay, and is it not standard in the industry that subrogation is an integral part of private or self-funded, whatever? That's just one of the provisions that are in the contract.
Yes, Your Honor, I would concede that in most contracts, subrogation is provided.
Probably
although there
all
are.
Health insurance providers have this kind of subrogation issue.
My understanding, and as cited in the amicus brief, there are some plans that provide for no, some plans provide for proration, some plans provide for no subrogation, but we certainly concede, Your Honor, that the vast majority of plans do provide for subrogation. But in order
so
to insure.
No, let me finish the question here. So there is literally very little bargaining power that this employee has in the assumption of health coverage for a family.
The two parts to that question, two answers to that question. One, the employee can insure against those rights that are at issue here by purchasing additional underinsured motorist coverage.
Well, what happens if the injury was caused by an accident that was not an automobile accident?
Then the plan covers it completely.
And
it's not, there's not a subrogation
issue
then.
But there's a tortfeasor, and it has nothing to do with the automobile.
My understanding is from the plan is that that is covered then.
That's covered, and if they sue the tortfeasor, which was not an automobile accident, you will not go for subrogation. You will not exercise your right of subrogation. Is that the plan?
My understanding is, I'm sorry, Your Honor, in an accident in which there is not a
not an automobile involved, so there is no insurance.
I'm sorry, then. I guess that would be, we would consider that also.
There's no automobile insurance, but say
right,
there's homeowner's insurance or some other insurance that is totally divorced from the concept of a motor vehicle.
Then the plan would pursue its subrogation rights.
Right. Under any circumstance where there's a deep pocket, you will, and that there is an award.
Yes, Your Honor.
The health insurance industry, for the most part, will exercise a subrogation clause of a contract.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. The other part to that question, I believe, Your Honor, is the negotiating. Where the employer negotiates the contract with the health plan, and the employer is in the best position to negotiate, has the most experience and economic clout and most knowledge to negotiate the best terms. In this case, the school districts negotiate with NBEC for the best terms, and as opposed to the individual.
The best terms for the
for its
employer
members.
As opposed to the employees?
And its employees also. The employees have representatives as part of that negotiating process.
Okay. Thank you, you've used your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. O'Neill, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
The first case in Ohio of make-whole doctrine was Newcomb versus Cincinnati in 1872. It was equitable. The second Supreme Court case was Peterson. The third one was Irvin. They distinguish it because they were contract subrogation clauses. Then in James versus Michigan Mutual in 1985, they say the subrogation clause that is contractual still is, it will be treated like it is equitable, and they reaffirmed the Newcomb of the make-whole doctrine in contractual versus equitable subrogation as to its enforcement were indistinguishable. When you get to Horanco, when you look at it, it is you look to see if the person is compensated first, and then after they have been compensated, then you look to the subrogation provisions. It does not make a difference in the enforcement of the provisions, whether it is equitable or contractual. James versus Michigan Mutual and Horanco both dealt with contractual subrogation, both said full compensation first. Justice Wright in a 7-0 decision is not a flowery person who throws words around. It is a 7-0 decision. It is a stare decisis and syllabus law of this court.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.